This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to read a good book. And boy, do I have a good book for you today.
I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper today one of my very favorite authors, David Baldacci. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, great. Well, it is so nice to talk to you again. I get to talk to you quite often because you are so prolific.
That's right.
And the new book, well, I always look forward to all of your books. And I particularly love the Memory Man series. So I always know it's the first chapter is going to grab me. And whoa, this is so good. When you read the first chapter and you know that you're not going to put that book down for a long time and you have to tell everyone around you, okay, don't bother me today. That's it. I've got something here that's really so special. I'm not going to give it up lightly. And that's exactly what happened with the new book, which is called The Fallen. And, of course, as always, I love the entire Memory Man series because Amos Decker, the detective who suffered, you know, two tragedies in his life, is such a compelling hero. And we all just feel for him throughout the book.
He is. He's quite the unusual character. You know, he's the guy with a perfect recall because of a traumatic brain injury. So that's how really he conducts his investigations. He listens to everybody. He sees all the stuff, and he looks for inconsistencies and contradictions. And this little, you know, Rust Belt town in western Pennsylvania, Barronville, it only exists because a guy named John Barron 120 years ago or so found coal there and decided he could build textiles there, a textile mill. So the town thrived. People came there to work, they had families, they put down roots, they built homes, and then, as happens across the country, the coal ran out, and you can make textiles a lot cheaper overseas, so the businesses went away, and you still have the people living there, and then they have nothing there for them. So he goes to this place, and in the first chapter, as you pointed out, he sees the spark of light in the window of a house backing up to the one he's staying in, and he goes to investigate it, finds that body's there.
And then he finds things. And as always with your books, the problem is we don't want to give too much away, but the entire book, of course, the story of a small town that has been devastated by, you know, by time, and the problems that these small towns face with drugs is a very big part of the book. And, you know, for Amos, who's, they're supposed to be on vacation, it steps right into a major, major investigation.
Yeah, he does. And it just, you know, it's, he doesn't want to really be there on vacation. He's there because Alex Jameson's sister lives there and she sort of forced him to go, which kind of humanizes him a little bit, I guess. But he runs, you know, headlong into another mystery. And finds out that, you know, the town has a very dark underbelly to it, and as other bodies turn up and other things start to happen, he realizes that this place is not nearly what it seems to be.
Well, it's not the small town America that we have in our minds, because it's pretty dark nowadays. The drug problem is very real. When you hear about these states, like a state like Vermont, where there is such a very, very big problem with drugs, and across the Rust Belt, it's the same thing. You must have done quite a bit of research into this.
I did. You know, my mother is from a Rust Belt town. Hers was coal mining in Southwest Virginia, and the only reason the town was there was because the coal was there. So when the coal went away, the town still was there, but there was nothing for the people, no work for them to do, and they were sort of left behind. And my hometown of Richmond, Virginia, could have been a Rust Belt town, but they have a great university there that's really brought the town back. But a lot of places don't have that. So we have these issues across the United States, and the opioid crisis on top of that is almost like a double blow. Because these people are already sort of down and out because the jobs aren't there. And then you have, you know, a town of 900 people in West Virginia, and there's a pharmacy there that, you know, where 15 million prescriptions for opioids have been written. How does that make sense? Because it's just a really bad issue. And one as a nation, you know, aside from the fictional story of the novel, one as a nation, we have to confront.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about novels, is that it does make people aware of things that they might not have been aware of.
I hope that's the case with this one as well. I mean, I want people to enjoy the novel. I want them to be entertained, but I also want them to come away a little bit more informed about, you know, the plight that's taking place with their fellow citizens, and maybe the steps that they can do to try to help solve the problem, or at least be aware of it. And that's what I try to do.
Well, I think that's that's always a nice part of a great book, is that there is, you know, Dickens wrote stories, but there was always this background of the horrible plight of the common people in his stories. So it does bring, it really serves a very important purpose, where a nonfiction book, people aren't going to generally pick up a nonfiction book and read about the opioid crisis. But when they read it in a novel, and which is well written, as yours are, that grip you, and you really care about the people, and you start to think of them as your friends, and you want to see their lives better, and you want, if there is anything, exactly as you said, if there's some way that we can help them, you want to do it. And so I think that's a sign of a great writer, just like Charles Dickens.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because you're spot on about Dickens. He wrote about the poverty and life of the lower classes in England, and particularly in London. And I think the novels can be very powerful when they're talking about real world issues. That's what I tried to do in the poem.
In many cases, novelists have brought to the forefront problems that people might not have known. You know, if you're from a different area, a different background, you might not be aware of these problems. But that's why we need well-written books that people can read and enjoy, and at the same time learn something.
Right, exactly. I totally agree.
And of course, all of your books are all of your books are so wonderful. And as I was saying, this first chapter, going right into that exciting second chapter, and throughout there, there are many depths to this story, because it's a story, of course, of not just of the opioid crisis, but also the mystery, a historical mystery mixed in there, which is always fun. The great thing is that you really do make us care about the character so much that when I got to the end, I so wanted a particular ending, because I did want, you know, you do want good things to happen to good people. And so, you carried us through this very exciting, there's action, there's you know, all of this. But I think it's a great book.
Well, I appreciate that very much. And, you know, I definitely try to do that. And I want to, you know, continue to let the characters grow and evolve and become more and more human with every book. And when I just got back from overseas, and I was at the London Book Fair, and the reports over there that crime fiction has exploded. It's become the number one most popular genre in the United Kingdom. And people, all sorts of journalists asked me about that. And I said, well, I think it's because the world right now is so uncertain. It seems like so many bad people are getting away with everything. So in crime fiction, at least, you have good and bad. And at the end of the novel, the bad is punished and the good sort of triumphs. I think people want that kind of certainty and that sort of ending, and at least in the fictional story, to get away from all the news that's happening in the real world, but they don't get that result. So I think that's really interesting that that's become the most popular genre.
Well, I think it's true, because the minute I got your book, everything else, I didn't want to hear about anything else. I didn't want to know the news. I didn't want to know anything. I just had to get into the book and become part of the town, and finding out and solving along with you the different mysteries. And so I think it's just fantastic.
Very much.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, I always do when I'm talking to writers, I talk about first chapters and I talk about you. I always love when writers will say, new upcoming writers will, he's so great, he can do it. And I say, well, one, he can do it because he's worked hard to learn how to do it. But two, he has been rejected. It's not, you know, they get sometimes new writers, young writers, they get upset that they're being rejected, and they're doing the query letter bit, and they get so upset after four or five queries, and they say, you know, I'm never going to get anywhere. But I say you have to be persistent. But in your case, I think you have a very interesting query letter story that I think people might appreciate.
Yeah, I have been rejected many times, and I was a young writer, you know, on the outside of the glass looking in for a long time. And it's a struggle, and it's a gauntlet you have to run, but you got to keep believing in yourself and keep going. So the query letter I had for my first novel, Absolute Power, is very short. I said, I'm David Baldacci. I'm a lawyer in Washington, D.C. Absolute Power is about the president, a burglar, a cover-up, and with the Secret Service. And I think, and I guarantee you, if you read the first page, you won't stop until you read the last page. And the reason I wrote that, one, I felt like I needed to be confident in my own material, because if I couldn't be confident, how could I expect others to be? And two, I was almost convinced that, you know, half of them would read the book just to prove me wrong. So they could write me and tell me, you know, this book is awful. You're wrong. You have no talent. But so it worked for me. You know, they all called back. They all wrote back and said, hey, this is great. We'd love to be your agent. But sometimes, you know, you got to be a little bit original, a little bit clever, and lift your, you know, your query letter or your manuscript out of the slush pile that's sitting around every New York publishing house.
I know. And it's so hard to tell people, you know, they ask my advice. And of course, I have a lot of literary agents who come on the program, and they all have, you know, strict rules, you know, and it's so nice that, you know, you got past that. And I know another author, a woman who, she won't let me tell what she wrote, but she actually wrote one sentence in her query letter, very much like yours, and she got a book deal, you know, within a month. So you don't know, but the whole thing is you have to be persistent. And even if you are rejected, because you were rejected before, you know that you just have to believe in yourself. If you believe in your writing and you know your writing is good, you just have to continue.
You do. You do have to believe in yourself and know that when you get rejected, you're not alone. We all get rejected. That's just part of the process. It's a very subjective business, and people can reject material for lots of different reasons. You know, one, they may not have liked the subject matter or the writing style, or they could be having a bad day, or they might be jealous that you're actually a good writer and they don't want to help you. I mean, it's just people are people. So you can't really, if they give you constructive criticism that will help you and make you a better writer, that's great. If it's all negative stuff, then, you know, you need to, it's almost like a baseball pitcher who's given up a home run or a cornerback who's given up a touchdown. You got to forget about it, and you got to keep moving forward.
Now, when you're writing, do you have a nice, you probably have a beautiful office where you're writing? Yes?
I do. I have an office outside the house. I have a staff of people that are there who handle all the stuff aside from the writing, you know, the business, publicity, and all the other stuff. It allows me to focus on what I do. But with that said, if I'm in town, I go there every day and I work there every day. I tell people the perfect place to write is not a physical space. It's in your head. If you're in the zone, I just got back from overseas yesterday. I was overseas for a week promoting the Fallen over there. And I wrote on an Irish ferry going across the Irish Sea. I wrote on a train. I wrote on multiple planes. I wrote in the green room of a television studio. I was getting ready to go on to do a show. So if you're in the zone in your head, you can write in the middle of anything. I'll go to a little Greek restaurant that I like near my home and have a little table in the back. I have my laptop, and I work with 150 people having lunch around and talk. And I'm in the zone, and I'm totally oblivious to everything else. And I've gotten a lot of good writing done there. So if it's in your head, if you're in the zone in your head, you can write anywhere.
Well, thinking about Europe, is it true that there in Italy there's a town that has a David Baldacci Day?
It's the town where my grandfather was born, and so they proclaimed the day David Baldacci Day. Over there, not knowing they had done that, I thought I was just having lunch with the mayor. I took my family with me, and it turned out it was this whole extravaganza of events. You know, it was lunch with the mayor and my family and friends and like 1,100 other people. And I had to give a grand speech in the center courtyard of the city, and they gave me all these gifts to take back. And it was quite the day. They flew the American flag over the city for the first time since World War II when the Americans came through and liberated the town.
Oh, wow. That's nice.
It was quite something. It really was.
That was a great honor. Of course, now your family has been in Virginia a long time, and I wanted to talk about, you know, first of all, just a little bit about the new book, The Fallen. The Fallen is a great book, and I want all my listeners to get it because it is, the story is just told so well, as David Baldacci always does. That's what I tell people. I say, it's David Baldacci. What do you want? It's going to be great writing. and The Memory Man, and this one is particularly good. I mean, right from the very first Memory Man, they've all been fantastic. But I wanted to, I never have really enough time with you. I wanted to talk about, a little bit, about Wish You Well. Not your Wish You Well Foundation, but Wish You Well, the book. Because, you know, I know I've read all the Memory Man and all the John Puller books. But what I had not read was Wish You Well, which is an absolutely wonderful book. It's not available in print. And I had a choice between Kindle and Audible. And so I took the Audible. And that is one of the best Audible books I've ever listened to.
Well, I appreciate that very much. It's probably, people ask me what's the favorite book I've written. Most of the time I will say Wish You Well. It was a very personal book for me. The way that people lived in that book was based on my maternal family growing up in a mountaintop in Southwest Virginia. And the story was fictional, but it still had deep meaning. That was made into a film a few years ago with Ellen Burstyn in the lead role. And it was just a beautiful book and very different from anything I've ever written before. But it was not left for me to, you know, to write a different story that I wanted to write. It's been very popular. A lot of people have enjoyed it, so I'm glad to.
And as I said, the Audible version, the narration is so great. One feels very calm as one is listening to this story. And your writing is poetic in this book.
I really focused a lot on the prose. I had a lot of things I was juggling, but the story, the dialogue, the plot, and all that. But I wanted the words to come alive in this book because I wanted the geographic location. I wanted the mountains to be a character. The way you do that is really through the words that you choose. And I took a great deal of time with the prose to make every word exactly the word that I wanted it to be and exactly the place that I wanted it to be. It really was a labor of love. I had a wonderful time writing that novel.
As I said, I think it's an example of somebody who really has fine-tuned their craft because, as you said, you worked on probably every word just to get that particular feeling in a paragraph, in a sentence, and it certainly succeeds. And I want to tell my listeners that they really should get this book. I think what happens with authors, sometimes they think, well, they're doing a particular genre. They think, well, I have to stick with that. I can't write maybe what I want. You know, I heard from somebody who's writing in a genre that they think is commercial. But she said to me, I can't write what I want because nobody will buy it. But I said, if it's well written, if it's something that you have the passion for, and your passion is in that story, in this particular one, where I think your mother helped you with it, or your family told you stories?
I interviewed her. Yeah, I interviewed her just to get a reminiscence of the memories of the time growing up back in the 1930s and 1940s in that very hardscrabble life. So it was, most people don't sit down and interview their parents about their past. Most kids are kind of like, my parents didn't have much of a history until I came along.
Yeah.
Well, they did. They did. They had a life before you came along. And I really delved deeply into my mom and my grandmother's life to really, you know, build have the building block, build the rural setting and how these people lived, how their lives were back then. And so she, you know, her memories and recollections are very important.
And you've preserved them in this wonderful, wonderful book. And when I'm talking to writers, I say, we all have interesting families. Some of us have crazier families, some of us, you know, different, but there's always, you know, something interesting in our families. And if this is one of the ways to sort of get to your roots, to really understand yourself, is to write a book about your family.
Yes, it absolutely is. I think I would encourage everybody to sort of dip more deeply into their family's history and past. And ask your parents, ask your grandparents, if you're lucky enough to have great-grandparents, sit down, because otherwise sometimes those memories and that part of our lives, our history, gets lost. Our history used to be all about oral history, you know, one generation would hand it down to the next. We've gotten away from that. I think that's a bad thing. I think people, we have to have that continuity. We have to know where we come, the struggles of people that came before us, the decisions they made that maybe changed our lives because they decided to go to this place or take that job or go to college, not go to college, or take a risk and maybe go to another country. And all the decisions they made before us really impacted our lives because they ended up where did our parents end up? Where did we end up?
Now, so when you wrote Wish You Well, that was absolutely a work of love. When you're writing, do you find that, first of all, do you rewrite a lot? because everyone always says to me, well, again, this is another thing I get. Between the query letter and the and people saying, oh, I don't think this person got rejected. They're always saying, well, I don't think that person has to ever rewrite anything. They write it just, it comes out like that.
Oh, no, no. I write constantly. You know, I'm editing the book every time I sit down to go through it. I edit, edit, and edit. And then when it's done, I print it out and I take my pens and I butcher it more. You know, the novel comes to life in the editing process. You know, you put up this kind of, you put out this huge mound of malleable clay and you got everything in there, but some parts you don't need, some things you need more of. You need to shape it and mold it and fix it and put it into something that's going to be recognizable and pleasing to the eye. And it all comes through the editing process. It's just, that's the part I love the most about it, because I know I'm fashioning what's going to be the end product that people are going to enjoy. It takes a lot of work. There's no easy way to do it, nor should there be. But as part of the process, I probably love the best.
And, of course, you are also always great at research. And one of the things in the new book, The Fallen, it is set around in this town of Barronville, one of these new fulfillment centers, which I also found fascinating because I didn't know very much about what they look like. And so you really described it. Did you get to visit a fulfillment center?
I have visited them. I've talked to people that work in them. And, you know, they are... It's crazy how enormous they are. I mean, you can fit like 30 football fields in some of these places, and you have 20,000 people working at them. And it's like the 21st century version of, you know, sweat labor, because you're judged on how many boxes you fill, and, you know, if you're not running hard enough, they're going to find somebody who can work harder than you, and then you're having to work next to robots who you can never outwork. And at the end of the day, I think that most of these places would rather just, you know, have robots work there, because you don't have to feed them, or they don't get sick, they don't take vacation. But one of the classic lines that Decker had in the novel, it was the guy who runs the center was explaining all this to him. He said, well, if people don't have jobs, who's going to buy all this crap? You know, so that's the catch-22.
Well, I think the new book is great, and it's called The Fallen. I'm sure you're working on something new coming up.
I am. Yeah, in November it'll be a brand new series. And something I've never done before. I've written a lot about females in my book. I've never had a female who's the lead protagonist in a series. So her name is Atlee Pine, and she's an FBI agent, and she works in the wild, wild west, western part of the United States, in the middle of nowhere, where she's like the only FBI agent for hundreds of miles.
Oh, boy.
Fascinating character with a great backstory, so I'm super excited about her, and she'll be coming out in November.
Well, David, again, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper. I just celebrated my third anniversary. And so,
congratulations.
You know, it's been an absolutely fantastic time. And the biggest thrill, of course, is to get to talk to all of my favorite authors. And you are right up there. And I always look forward to your books and get so excited because I know that you're going to deliver something that will just be gripping. And when we talk about page turners, the new book, The Fallen, is a page turner.
Well, thank you. I always enjoy being on the show, and I'm glad you love books so much, and you bring them to lots of people across the country. That's a great thing you do.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Dave. Bye.
Okay. Well, that was fun. I always love to talk to him. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then I've got a really interesting guest on.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented my pillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. My pillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed. It's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry my pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
My pillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. I'm so happy to welcome her to the program because she has written a book that is, first, it's beautiful, and second, it's a book that makes a difference. And I always love to read books that will make a difference in people's lives. So I'm so happy to welcome Kristen Kay to the program today. Hi, Kristen.
Good morning, Patsy.
Wow, this book, it's called Tree Dreams, is really fantastic.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to hear that. I've put a lot of work into it, so it's wonderful to hear your excitement for it.
Well, you know, I grew up in northern Michigan. All of my family was involved in logging, but my father was one of the first people who wanted and tried to change sort of the outlook of logging and make sure that trees were planted. For every tree that came down, a new tree was planted, or two trees were planted. And so this has been part of my life, and I love trees, and my happiest memories are being in a hammock, between two trees, and this is what I love. I spent my whole childhood reading books under trees. So this book is very, very special.
Oh, that's so wonderful to hear. You know, I've met so many people who have similar stories about these incredible relationships they've had with trees, places that were safe havens for them to go sit, where they could read books like you describe or dream under. They are really made personal connections that you can ask, I think, almost anyone, and they'll be very happy to tell you about the tree that's their favorite place.
Exactly. Now, let's talk about how you came about with the idea for this and your background, because Tree Dreams is it's so beautifully written. It's poetic and lyrical and absolutely delightful. So tell us why this book? How did it grab you?
Oh, I'd be happy to tell you. Yes. Well, you know, a long time ago in the early 1990s, I was in Muir Woods, just north of San Francisco. And for anybody who doesn't know, Muir Woods is where some of the biggest, oldest redwood trees still stand. And I was taking a tour of these magnificent trees, and there was a placard that described something called family circles, which is a survival mechanism, a mechanism that redwood trees use. So essentially, when a redwood tree dies, new trees grow in a circle around where that tree stood from its roots. And so these circles are all over redwood forest. And I was standing in front of this placard with this family circle before me, and there was something so intimate about this circle of trees. And a question popped into my heart, which was, what do we do when something we love dies? Do we do something similar? Do we get together and draw new life from the life that came before? Or do we tend to draw lines in the sand that separate us from them, you know, to protect us against loss and to protect what's ours? And somehow this question just really nagged at me for a very long time. I became very curious about what we do as human beings in our communities and as individuals to respond to that kind of change. And A number of years later, I found out about a logging town in Northern California that had been a logging town for 100 years and had managed the land fairly decently for a long time. But the logging town was then bought by a corporation in Texas that came in and essentially annihilated the forest around the area. And then the corporation went bankrupt and put the town up for sale. And this was kind of the second part to my question. All of a sudden, I was seeing in life an example of a specific area and a specific town that was going through an incredible amount of change, and how were they responding? And the seeds of that really inspired the book. And there are many other parts of inspiration that went into this, but that was the original source of the question that spurred me to write Tree Dream.
Well, the main character in this book is a 17-year-old girl named Jade Reynolds, and the story centers around something that she witnesses. So tell us about how you came out with the character of Jade, because she's fascinating, and a little bit about the story.
Of course. So Jade is the daughter of a logger. And so Jade grows up in the logging town that I describe in real life. I based the book on this town. And so Jade is a character that is well-versed in logging, and her family are all loggers and have been for generations and have a very deep connection to the land. Yet Jade is somebody who has more of a, let's call it a mystical relationship to the Redwood Forest. When she's in the forest, she has dreams that give her insight into things she wouldn't normally have insight to, and she finds herself very confused and stuck trying to understand, well, what do you do with a language like the language you can develop with trees in a place that doesn't share that language? And so at the beginning of the book, there is a standoff between loggers and environmentalists in this town. And she witnesses a very violent encounter between a local logger who happens to be her uncle and an environmentalist who is likely living at a tree sit. And she, because she is witness to this, she is concerned and scared she'll be implicated. She also doesn't know if her father has participated in this. And more than that, she really does not know what to do with everything she feels about the forest. And she runs away because she's 17 and she doesn't know what to do. So she leaves as a way to escape. And this story then takes place as she discovers her voice and tries to figure out what is the right response to a situation like this.
Well, first, I lived in Sausalito. So I'm very familiar with that area. And
yes,
for anyone who hasn't been there, they really should make that trip, because it is like no place on earth.
Yeah, I agree.
You strain your neck. You just look it up there and you say, wow, how can anything be as magnificent as a redwood?
Both seeing the trees, because they're so huge. I mean, you can really feel, because some of them are 1,000 to 2,000 years old. So you can think to yourself as if you're standing next to a dinosaur, you know, both the size and the age of them. But I feel like there's also something really incredible walking through the woods, which is the sense of quiet and the sense of stillness. And the trees being so big and so vibrantly alive, even in their stillness, you really can feel as if you are on another planet almost. It is such a different kind of experience from any other forest, really.
And it's magical.
It's really humbling, yeah.
It is really magical.
Yes.
So, and the characters that you have brought into this book I just delighted in the way you wove the story. As you said, she comes from a logging family, and since I come from a logging family, I know exactly that feeling. I mean, I love the smell of sawdust. I love even the sound of the mill, because it's something very special. And my father used to talk about how, you know, so many of the trees that were from northern Michigan were transported all the way across over to Oregon, where they would be made into paper. And so every time I pick up a book, I think, well, maybe that was one of, you know, the trees from our area. I'm reading a book, you know. So you love, you know that it's important. We need trees for all of these things, but we do want people to think about it as something so special, and that we have to preserve the forest. And when we do take, you know, what we need, and that's all we should take is what we need to reforest.
Yes. You know, it's very interesting because in writing this, you know, people would ask me, well, are we not supposed to use forests? And should we not be cutting down trees? You know, what are you really saying here? And I think one of the things that was most striking is that, you know, as you described, there is a beauty to being in the forest. There's a beauty to the mill, as you described, the smell of sawdust. All of these things are very sensual, and they're very satisfying. And this book, in my perspective, is not at all to say those things shouldn't happen. What I really got to in the story was more that there is an appetite that we seem to have cultivated over time, which is an appetite that says we can take whatever we want and we can take as much of it as we want. And we look and are paying attention to only really what's above ground. Well, there are trees there, and we can grow lots of them. We can replace them, and there are, or now all the trees are gone because we've clear cut or we've taken so much, and then there's upset about that. And what we have failed to see thus far is that actually there's a much bigger picture. You know, we're all this research that we're finding out now recently about the sophisticated forms of communication that trees have underground in the roots and between trees and between whole ecosystems. I fear as humans that we have had a very narrow view of the natural world around us. And so this book is really speaking to, yes, we need to be very intentional about what we're using and how we're using it, but even more, we need to see the bigger picture. We need to understand our place in the bigger picture of things and the bigger picture of the ecosystem and where we fit within it so that we can understand better how we can relate to it.
Well, you know, the book is, they're sort of advertising it as young adult, which is a great demographics to reach. And you know, because we want to influence young people to really think about exactly what you said, that think about the whole picture of trees, not just you know what we see, but what's underneath the ground, and what they mean to the planet, the importance of it, and it breaks my heart when I think of what they're doing in Amazon, for example, clear cutting, and so any time that we can get people to understand that we have to use some intelligence and. If we can find trees like bamboo that grows rapidly, and we can use that, so much the better.
I think that there's a lot that's going on. One of the ways that I prepared to write this book was to do a lot of research into the topic of forest and forestry, and spent a good amount of time trailing conservation foresters in Oregon and really learning from them, learning when they look at a forest or they look at a stand of trees, you know, are they thinking 10 years out or are they thinking 100 years out? And what the difference is between those two perspectives in terms of how they manage the land. If it's 10 years out, there tends to be more of an emphasis on making as much money as possible out of this particular stand of trees. If it's 100 years out, it's understanding that actually the overall health of the grove is more important to our air quality and the quality of our water, and what are the ways in which they can serve that longer health. And so starting to incorporate that perspective into everything we do. I mean, the fact is with redwood trees, there's only 3% of the redwood forest that originally stood. And we're seeing across the world the repercussions of a mindset that says that we can take as much as we want. And our oceans are filled with plastic, and our forests are really suffering, which affect our air quality and affect our water. And so we're in a position that it's imperative for us to be reconsidering the things that we've overlooked. And Tree Dreams is tries to tell a story about the many aspects of the things we tend to overlook, which also include our dreams and also include a symbolic language that can be used to help us rethink our place in the family of things.
Well, is there anyone, thinking about that, is there anyone who is thinking 1,000 years out? Is there anyone who is actually planting redwoods to make sure that we have in 1,000 years redwoods?
That's a great question. You know, there is a gentleman who they're looking into figuring out how to take the genome of certain older and longer living trees and figuring out what to do with that. If there's a way that we can cultivate it so we can plant more of it and protect what's left.
Well, I would think actually, you know, thinking about that, I would think that they would be able to get people to donate money for trees if they said, okay, we're going to name this tree, you know, your family name or whatever, and it could be here 1,000 years from now. You know, people want all these things named for themselves, but boy, can you imagine having a redwood and in 1,000 years it's your family's name? I think that's fantastic.
Oh, well, it's definitely an interesting way to get people interested in recognizing that longevity is important. Absolutely. Well, you know, actually, I'm just as a reminder, it just came to me, the gentleman who's doing it, his organization is called the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive. And they're the ones that are cultivating an archive of older and champion, bigger and champion trees. Well, and helping to reforest the earth with the offspring of these.
Okay, well, now this book is your first novel?
It's my first novel. It's not my first book, but yes, it's my first novel.
It's your first novel. Well, first novel is always something very, very, very special in an author's life. Now, you know, so you came out with the idea of the young girl. I mean, right from the beginning, you knew you were going to use the 17-year-old as, right? That was your character?
Yes, she kind of popped into my head. The character that popped into my head was actually ultimately a little younger, but it was a character who really had a sensibility of her connection to the wider world and was woven into that sensibility and woven into the forest around her in a way that she couldn't see the separation between trees and herself as one being more important than the other.
Now, how did you find an agent for this? Did you?
So I've been working with a very interesting press called Spark Press, which uses a hybrid publishing model. So with this book, I did not agent it.
And so now, what are you doing? Are you doing book tours for this book?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm reading up and down the West Coast, and was just in Portland. I'll be back in Portland. I have a number of readings around the Bay Area.
Now, I noticed on your website, which is very nice, that you have something called Tree Dreams Kits. Tell us about that.
So one of the challenges, as I described, that my character has is that she's trying to figure out how to communicate what she learns from trees, especially in a place that doesn't share the language and doesn't quite believe what she has to say. So inspired by the idea of the circle of family circles of redwoods that grow new life from what has been lost, she considers the things that she's learned from trees and the things that she feels when she's in the forest and chooses to write them down on small tags. And she hangs these tags in a circle around her town that is up for sale. And this is her way of writing a new narrative about how we can be awake to our relationship to the natural world. And so the character does this as one of the ways in which she is trying to resolve her dilemma. But I was jealous of her, quite frankly, and I wanted to tag trees too. And so I got together with a friend of mine who is an incredible designer and has an antique letterpress in her garage and in her studio in the backyard. And she helped me to make these kits. And so the kits contain a small book that is the Tree Dreams Field Guide to Interconnection, which is a collection of quotes and facts about the ways that we are connected, but also forest facts and tree facts and quotes about stewardship. And the kits come with this little book and tags and twine. And the idea is that we can share, similar to root systems that communicate important information for the benefit of the grove, that through tagging trees, we can communicate the ideas that can sustain us all. And so I started tagging trees, and then other people started tagging trees, and pretty soon Tree Dreams tags, they're hanging across the world and across the U.S., and teachers have been adapting it for the classroom. So this is one way that the story is actually left from the book and into the world.
Well, that's what I was saying at the beginning, that I love books that make a difference in people's lives, make a difference in the world. And this book certainly has. It's so sweet. The book is, you know, it's delightful in that you right away get into the character. You start to understand this magical feel that she has for trees. And then to find out that you've put it together, these Tree Dreams kits, which if people can go to, it's called treedreams.net, and they can see, and that's where they can post their pictures, right?
Yes, absolutely. So you can get Tree Dreams kits there, and then you can also, when you have been tagging trees, take pictures of your tag, and you submit those pictures to the website, and we put them up straight away. So they're included.
As a homeschool mom, when I was homeschooling my kids, this is exactly the kind of project that they would have loved to do, you know, because we spent a great deal of our time homeschooling. We did it outside. We spent a lot of time in the parks.
Yes.
Because one of the things I would do, we would do like treasure hunts, and I would hide things under the bushes and under the trees, and then they'd have to run around the park. It was a great way for me to have some time to sit, but they'd have to run around while I could watch them, but and pick up the clues. And so I love this idea of these, you know, it's just delightful.
Oh, thank you so much. It has been really incredible, the feedback that we've gotten on these Tree Dreams kits for the reasons that you're describing. It's a simple and great way to get outside with small groups or large groups or people of all ages, really. But what's been incredibly interesting has been some of the stories that have come back about how deeply it's affected people. And you know, you can take a group of kids outside and in some ways talk, you know, in more scientific terms about interconnection, and you can stand in a park and consider how a tree on one side of the park is connected to a tree on the other side, and, you know, talk about the fungal network that makes that happen. But you can also talk about things like resilience, and you can talk about how trees have, and nature has an incredible way of being able to bounce back from challenges. But then suddenly that idea turns into a story of resilience for people as well. And you can then expand that to ask people, you know, with your group, well, how are you resilient? And it's been very interesting to hear some of the stories. I was talking to a teacher in Charlottesville who happened to be there on, you know, that awful day last fall when that young woman was killed during that protest. And she was talking about how she had been down there and they had said it was a state of emergency and she had to leave. And she at the time didn't exactly know what was happening. And I asked her, well, what has it been like now? And how does it feel now afterwards? And she said, one of the things that was most amazing was that all the schools in the town actually got letters from other schools and kids across the U.S. Just in support of them and and just sending them care and consideration.
Well, Kristen, I don't have much time left, but
yes,
I do want to tell
people
that this is a great book. It's not just for young adults. I think every adult will enjoy this because we all have our, as you said, our tree stories of what we did as children and you know, when you're older and you're sitting under a tree, boy, that makes you feel good. And that's one of the joys of life, really, our trees. And so I want to thank you for the book. Tree Dreams is available wherever books are sold. And you can go to Kristen Kay's website. It's kristenkay.com. And also then look at the Tree Dreams kits there. And Kristen, I want to thank you so much for being on today. I think you've done a job that is so important of getting people interested in protecting the environment and mostly in just loving trees.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to be on your show this morning. Thank you, Patsy.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Wow. This is really lovely. If you check out her website, you will see and go to the treedreams.net. Now, we are in this area. We are very lucky. We have beautiful botanical garden here in Largo, Florida. If you haven't been to it, you have to go to it. Everything is just in bloom right now. It's a fantastic place, and it will make you want to read this book because Tree Dreams is a very, very nice book. And I was very happy to get it because, as I said, there's something very magical about the book. And it's would be a great gift for any young people in your life. So if you want to give a book as a gift, this is a wonderful book. Now, I want to also ask everyone, please go to my Facebook page and like me, and I will like you back. And you can send me messages, and several writers have sent me messages lately on Facebook, and they are going to be guests on the program. So it's a wonderful way to connect with me. And you can also go to my website, radio-joyonpaper.com, and I will have the archive up of this interview and other interviews so that you can see what's out there to read, because we all need something good to read. Get us away from the television. Get us away from all the crazy news that drives us drives us crazy. And read a good book. And David Baldacci's new book, The Fallen, is really wonderful. And so is this new book by Kristen Kay. And meanwhile, I just want to remind everyone that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky and very talented, to actually hear them on the big screen or the little screen. And for all of you cozy mystery writers, I know you all want to be on the Hallmark Channel someday, but you won't be there unless you actually sit down and start writing. So do that, and then meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, because he's always so nice to me, and he got Kristen on the phone, and it was a great day. So bye-bye for now.